Slicer Tangents is brought to you by Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the did we just hit a million order stage and everywhere in between. Sari and Hank, can you name anything that works so well? It's practically magic.
Dragonflies.
Toilets.
What? Yeah, okay. Well, here's one off the top of my head. How about selling with Shopify? Ooh. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and it helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Ooh. Not to mention, it's got award-winning customer support there to help you on your path to success. And those are just a few reasons to love Shopify. But Hank, what does your company, DFTBA, like so much about Shopify?
We've been using Shopify, I think, for over 10 years now, and it really has scaled extremely effectively with us. It is both a huge amount of information at your fingertips, but also in a way that makes it fairly easy to make the decisions you need to make, learn the things you need to learn, and do the things you need to do. It's all in there. And it's one of the great joys of my life is going into the Shopify backend and being like, look at all these people who wanted a thing that I had.
What a rich life you lead indeed.
And if you want to experience great joys like that too, I've got a magic trick for you. Poof. You can now try Shopify for a month for only $1. That's right. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tangents, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/tangents now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in, and experience the little joys of looking at the back end of a store. shopify.com/tangents, all lowercase. Abracadabra.
Hello and welcome to SciShow Tangents, the lightly competitive science knowledge showcase. I'm your host, Hank Green, and joining me this week, as always, is science expert and Forbes 30 Under 30 education luminary, Sari Riley!
Hello!
And our resident everyman, Sam Schultz.
Hi.
I have a question for you guys.
Okay.
Tell me the name of your pet, and then the name that you ended up calling your pet.
Oh. Lilu and Lilu. I don't mess around with those alternate names.
You don't have like a Lulilau or anything?
Nope.
You don't call her you don't call her Lilu Dallas Multipass?
Sometimes we used to call her that more often than we do now. She's just Lilu now. She's transcended that reference and it's purely just Lilu. But I understand the compulsion. My brother's name is Will and we call him Wilbur. And sometimes we call him Birdman because it's Wilbur turned into Bird. Turned into Birdman.
Birdman. Okay, so you don't have a story for your pet, but you do for your brother.
More
okay.
Accurate, yeah.
Our cat's name is Inky, which is also mm-hmm. something that you just say, and it has the same cadence as Lilu, yeah. But we call her so many different things. Stinko, mm-hmm. Bug, Bean. We have a subset of nicknames when she's being a gremlin in particular ways. So sometimes we call her Grem for gremlin for short. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we call her Dennis when she's being a menace. Sometimes we call her Marvin so when she's cute. Starving.
Oh, no.
And so she's got so many names, but they change depending on her behavior. She earns a title almost.
She's almost a different animal.
Yeah, at all moments of the day, whether we, when she's doing being great, oh, Inky, you're being so cute. When she's mm-hmm. being a Grim, Stinko.
Stinko Menace.
Yeah.
Stinko the Grim over there.
Yeah.
I have two cats. We have our new cat, Chester, who already, he's gone from Chester to Chester Cheese to just Cheese. Mm. I think maybe it was Chester Cheetah first. It was Chester to Chester Cheetah to Chester Cheese. Mm-hmm. And now just Cheese. We call him Cheese. At this point, which is not really a cat name. And then we have Gummy Bear, who is, we went from Gummy, we call him Gum and Gummy and Gumball and Gums. And when one day we came home from something And my son opened the door because gummy bear is always there when you open the door when you're coming home, just sitting there. And Oren said, "The expected gums." And so we call him the expected gums.
That's really good.
The expected gums and cheese sounds like the best, like, buddy cartoon characters.
Yeah. Catherine also walked by Gummy Bear this morning. And he was like hanging his arm off the cat tower like cats do. And Catherine looked at Gummy Bear, said, "Piggy dipping, ham hock, ding dong," which are all things that we say when he does that. We call it piggy dipping, which is a reference to an online video. And then ham hock came from us. And then ding dong was our old cat when she would hang her tail off the tower. We'd pull on it and go ding dong until we just had to say ding dong and she would lift her tail up.
She didn't want it to happen.
And I was like, did you just say piggy dip and a ham hock ding dong? I didn't think you were there.
We call that chicken wing behavior.
Cats are so good. Every week here on SciShow Tangents, we get together to try to one-up, amaze, and delight each other with science facts while also trying to stay on topic. Our panelists are playing for glory and for Hank Bucks, the currency in this podcast, which I have not mentioned outside of this intro for at least over a year, according to Eve. Hank Bucks.
It has become quite abstract, I think.
Yeah. We'll be awarded as we play it at the end of the episode. One of them will be crowned the winner. So, as always, we're going to introduce this week's topic with a traditional science poem, this week from Sarah.
Usually foods are pretty cut and dry. A potato's a potato, a fry's a fry. And you get kind of weird in the noodle zone, or a chocolate versus a blueberry scone. But usually you sort of know what you're eating, except for cheese, which can be quite deceiving. You might get a gooey processed square that melts on toasty bread, or a hard grainy slice from a big old wheel that weighs 7 times your head. A soft stringy lump that's stretched from curds, or a pillowy thickened whey, or a funky cube that reeks of feet or has ribbons of blue-gray. Then there's sprays in cans or shredded blends or neon dust to try. And lest we forget the cheese in quotes with nary a dairy inside. But it'd behoove us all to learn a few names of the hundreds or thousands vying for fame to help us with confidence say yes, please, when presented with a board of mystery cheese.
Cheese!
Beautiful.
It's the topic of the day, like my cat. And you've already let slip that it's not easy to define what a cheese is.
I thought you were going to tell us that a lot of those things weren't technically cheeses, but they are all indeed cheeses. It's not actually that hard to name what a cheese is.
Is easy cheese cheese?
I think it's a cheese product.
Cheese Whiz has dairy in it?
I think a lot of the processed cheeses, so spreadable cheese, Cheese Whiz, whatnot.
What we used to call in college regular cheese, which was Kraft American Singles.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Usually there's some sort of, well, I guess it depends. There's some sort of cheese percentage of it, just less than buying a hunk of cheese. So it's like you take some cheddar and then you add a bunch of additives to make it more spreadable, sprayable, dustable.
Or floppable. I mean, calling it American cheese is the greatest insult our nation has ever received. Also, all of the other nations too, like, we call it American cheese. That means South America,
they have
to some extent must feel responsible, which they definitely are not.
They didn't have anything to do with it.
That's United States cheese.
Where was it invented, huh?
Oh, it was definitely invented in America. It was invented in a laboratory at Kraft headquarters.
James L. Kraft patented the method.
It was probably some guy, and then he was like, I invented this.
Yeah, this is really the cheese that built a billion-dollar corporation right here.
He was Canadian.
Canadian cheese!
Canadian
this
cheese.
Is the biggest news that has ever been discovered on SciShow Tangent. Is he Canadian?
Canada is North America.
That's true. But
we
all know what they mean. Yeah. Yeah, he immigrated to Buffalo, New York in 1902 from Ontario, Canada.
Famous American-Canadian Kraft cheese man. His actually first name is Kraft. His last name is Cheeseman. Anyway, Sari, what's cheese?
You know, it. The thing is...
Weird milk.
Basically, it's a cheese describes the process of making cheese. And so you take a milk product, milk, cream, skim milk, buttermilk, some combination. Coagulate it with some sort of coagulating agent. In some cases, that is an acid. So like paneer cheese is by adding an acid to milk. A lot of times it is enzymes that we add to it. Some of the original cheese is made using rennet, which is a substance within the stomachs of ruminant babies. So like baby cows, baby sheep, baby goats.
Wild.
Are they okay when we get it from them?
I think they're probably not.
Oh, yeah. No. Okay.
We eat their meat and then we use their stomachs. But the reason they have it is because milk usually goes through your system pretty quick, but they have natural coagulants so that when they drink milk from their parents and get it in their tummies, it coagulates so it lasts longer and they can extract more nutrients from it, because that's like the whole thing that ruminants do is have stuff hang around in their stomachs for a while. And so at some point, humans probably stored milk in a stomach as a sack, because it's also in like nature's handbag is a stomach when it's outside the body. And then it started coagulating. And then if you remove the liquid, or you can remove some portion of the liquid and compress the solid stuff, then the solid stuff is technically cheese.
At that point, that's cheese.
At that point, it's cheese. Even if there's some whey mixed in, like cottage cheese is a mixture of curds and whey.
Cottage cheese. If you glopped a gloop of cottage cheese and I didn't know what that was and I ate it, I would not say that's cheese.
Yeah. You might be looking in the yogurt family, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I can see it. Like, it tastes cheesy, but I don't know. I feel like a cheese needs to hold its shape.
And that's why cheese is so tricky to pin down. It's like there's soft cheeses, hard cheeses, spready cheeses, stinky cheeses, sweet cheeses. Right.
I feel like that's actually kind of a pretty specific definition. As long as you take out the things that have quotation marks around it, then cheese products have cheese in them. And cheese is a thing that is like the solids left over after coagulation, or whatever you called it.
Yeah. Coagulation, yes. Okay. The curds. But then, I don't know. I see, now I'm poking holes in my own. I fell down such a rabbit hole trying to define cheese. Is tofu cheese? Because it's made from soy milk, coagulated, and
That's
pressed.
Not milk. We know what we mean when we say milk. Yeah. That's milk with quotation marks around it.
I think I agree with Hank, though, in that this is not a complicated or tricky definition at all.
I think it's
just comes in different flavors, you know?
I think Sarah's very brave for having brought is tofu cheese into the conversation.
Yeah, it's not. There's a whole section at the grocery store where all the cheese goes. That makes it pretty easy to figure it out.
Well, that actually, because I am going to completely make the case that Kraft Canadian cheese is not cheese.
Well, it's got, it's not made in the way that Sarah said,
it's got
said,
cheese
huh?
in it, just like my sandwich does. Like, pizza isn't cheese. And so Kraft Canadian cheese is not cheese.
This is right. You're right.
I'm so mad about it being Canadian.
It just doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like he earned it. It doesn't feel like we earned it. Just feels bad.
It's misattribution.
Mm-hmm. And I think if it was called Canadian cheese, everybody would treat it nicer and be more respectful of it, in my opinion.
Maybe it would treat us nicer and be more respectful of us.
That and that, too. It would be the most polite cheese.
The in Canadian our tummies, cheese. Be a little bit kinder as it goes down with the grilled cheese.
You know,
cheese.
I bet it probably has less lactose than most cheese. So maybe it is a little bit of a kinder cheese.
On the old belly.
So where did the word cheese come from?
So the word cheese comes from the Latin word caseus, which is where the word casein comes from. And queso. And all these words. Like, casein is the proteins that are found in mammalian milk. That is like about 80% of the proteins in cow's milk. So etymologically makes sense. But it also gave rise to the words cheese. I think they were basically pronounced the same way in Old English. But before the Latin, the linguists are duking it out with each other. Some of them think that it comes from a Proto-Indo-European root of quat, to ferment or to become sour. And another person is like, there's no way Latin has Q sounds in it. So there's no way we could have dropped the qua to turn it into cheese from there. And so I don't know. I'm not painting it very dramatically, but in the article...
You built it up a lot more than it turned out to be, for sure.
Yeah. And I guess in linguist terms, this is pretty much of a dig of no etymology can be found, which does not require some poorly founded assumptions, which I think was the person who thinks it's unknown making a dig at the fermentation.
Brutal. Fatality.
That is the trick with all of these words that we made up.
We stinky cheese people or not stinky cheese people? What are we thinking?
I'm not a stinky cheese person, though. I am not a stinky cheese man. I am a mild lad. I don't like flavor.
I'm a big time stinky cheese man. I've realized recently that my favorite cuisine is like what Wario or the Grinch would eat, where it's like very garlic heavy, very tangy, vinegar, that kind of just nasty flavors. I love it so much.
I think that growing up, Gargamel's a very unhappy man. But I think that you could grow up to be a happy Gargamel, you know? Who doesn't want to kill Smurfs for a living?
Well, yeah. Why can't I just be Wario or the Grinch? They both are happy.
I don't know if Wario is happy.
I think he's very happy. He seems happy. He's always smiling.
He seems happy, but like angry about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can be happy and angry. Happy isn't the opposite of angry.
Yep. That's right.
True. Yeah. He's like a gleeful
He's
angry
a gleeful
man.
Gargamel.
Anyway, that's not the thing that we're going to do for our game show today. Instead of that, we're going to be playing The Secret Ingredient. Of course we are. It's Cheese Day. One of the incredible things about cheese is how many variations we have come upon with the same basic premise. Over time, that ingenuity means that seemingly unusual ingredients like fungi, mites, and maggots have become part of long-standing traditions in the world of cheese. So today, we're going to be highlighting some of the strange ingredients of cheese in a game of Secret Ingredient. I will describe a type of cheese to you, but I will leave out one of the ingredients that makes the cheese what it is. And I'll give you three options for what the secret ingredient is, and it's up to you to figure out which one it is.
Makes sense.
So you actually get multiple choice this secret ingredient, which is going to make it less difficult. Are you ready?
Yes.
Yeah.
Our first cheese on the menu is Cornish Yarg, a cheese based on a 17th century recipe. That's real. I didn't make it up. That was rediscovered and adapted by a group of cheesemakers in Cornwall. This semi-hard cheese is made from cow's milk and has a distinct mushroom flavor. But what's particularly notable is a very local ingredient that is used to make its rind, which not only acts as the rind itself, but also provides the mushroom flavor and enzymes needed to mature the cheese. What is the secret ingredient? Is it A, lichen that grows on the Cornish cliffside, B, stinging nettles from the Cornish countryside, or C, sand taken from Cornish beaches?
Lichen seems the most mushroomy, doesn't it? But
Yeah, lichen's got fungi in it.
So this is like in the rind, or the whole rind is made out of this, or you don't know?
I think that the rind is made out of this.
Okay. And sand. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to go with sand, because that sounds like a cool story that I'd like to hear. I don't know why that would taste like mushrooms.
I would avoid the rind of a cheese that was rinded in sand, that's for sure.
That's true, and sometimes you sample the rind. That would be a big mistake.
I would be mad if I didn't go with the obvious one. I think it's lichen. I think you can pat that into a basket-ish shape and pour in cheese.
Well, Cornish Yarg is named for Alan Gray. Do you know why or how?
You just said a lot of words.
I'll get to the answer, but first, it's named for Alan Gray. How is Cornish Yarg named for Alan Gray?
Oh, backwards Yarg is backwards of Gray.
Backwards Yarg. So he found an old book called The English Housewife, and it contained instructions on various tasks, including how to make a number of cheeses. One of the recipes included a cheese matured on a bed of stinging nettles, though there weren't a lot of specifics on how to make this cheese. And Gray started testing out different versions of the recipe and created Cornish Yarg, eventually selling his recipe to another farmer that further tinkered with the recipe. Because, of course, we got to give everybody credit for the invention of this cheese. The nettles did ended up being an important part of the recipe. And cheesemakers who've worked on it have tested out different aspects of the nettles, like how much to be used and how to wrap the mold. And not the fungus mold, but the mold that is molded inside of. The nettles keep the cheese protected in a breathable coating that allows for specific molds to get attracted into the cheese. And the nettles are also gathered from the Cornwall countryside in the summer and then cleaned and frozen so that they can be used throughout the year. And the cheese is in the nettles for about 5 weeks while it matures.
I think my problem there was that I had no idea what stinging nettles were. I was picturing like burrs,
like an
you
animal?
Know, like. No, like saint, like the oh. things that get stuck on your shirt, like when you walk oh, past sure, a specific sure. plant, you know?
It's just, yeah. A, yeah, it's a leafy plant, but they do, it is very stingy. I hate them.
They make you real puffy looking, it looks like.
In 2022, the BBC reported that the most expensive cheese in the world is Puel, a Siberian cheese.
It sounds like I'm making it up.
named after Pierre Illoup. No. It's the Siberian cheese that became famous when the tennis player Novak Djokovic reportedly bought the entire stock from the one farm that produces it. The color was yellowish, and the BBC reporter sent to try it so that it tasted sweet, clean, and mild. According to cheese.com, Puel sells for about $576 per pound, a heavy price that results from the fact that the source of milk is not particularly bountiful. What animal produces milk for Puel? Is it yak, donkey, or deer?
Oh, well, deer are always running all over the place around. You can't pin them down to milk them. So I think there wouldn't be a lot of deer milk, and that's my guess, is a deer. I think a yak just stand there and let you milk it.
I'm going to guess donkey because it kind of sounds like mule.
As a luxury item, you say this is made of the finest deer milk. You know a rich person's going to be like, well, don't mind if I do. Donkey milk?
Shrek really skyrocketed donkey fame, though, I feel like.
It's not for the rich Shrek. And famous.
Yeah.
He's a tastemaker. Yeah.
Which donkey is this from precisely? The one that made babies with a dragon or a regular donkey?
Very luxurious. Only one rare dragon donkey.
Yeah.
Expensive cheese.
Actual answer, dragon. No, donkey. You're correct. The recipe is a secret, but one of the few things we know about it is that it's made using the milk from Balkan donkeys, which is a tough ingredient because while it takes about 25 liters of their milk to make 1 kilogram of the cheese, a female donkey will only make around 300 milliliters of milk per day. On top of the low milk yield that comes from working with donkeys, donkey's milk is tough to use for cheese because it has a low amount of casein. So to use their milk for the cheese, it needs to be mixed with goat's milk. Cheese is 60% donkey milk and 40% goat's milk.
Ah, this cheese doesn't sound very exciting to me. Seems like it's only expensive because that one guy bought it all.
Well, here's what it makes me think. I want to eat like every cheese. I want to eat cheese made from every mammal's milk.
Agreed.
Except people.
All right. Once you get done with all the rest of them, don't you think you'll be like, I guess I have
you're
to.
Right.
I guess it's time.
Working on my blog, and it's just like, I don't have anything else to post. So I guess
the last one.
All right. So someone has a point now, and that person is Sari. Next question. Emmental, that's a normal cheese I've heard of, is a popular Swiss cheese made from cow's milk that's often found in fondue and cheese plates. There are different varieties of Emmental, and the flavor itself can change based on how long you age it. And sometimes what matters is not just what you put in the cheese or how long it's aged, but what the cheese is surrounded by. In 2018, a Swiss cheesemaker wanted to test a theory he had about Emmental aging, so he collaborated with the University of the Arts in Bern on his theory. What did they do to the cheese's surroundings as the cheese matured? A, they kept the cheese in rooms painted different colors. What? B, they aged the cheese in containers with different fabric interiors. Or C, they played different genres of music to the cheese.
Well, I feel like the colors would do absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. Light I've, on the cheese. Yeah. Unless there's like something that was really photosensitive in it. Fabric, you're touching the cheese. So any sort of stuff could get in there.
That seems too obvious, kind of, though.
Oh, yeah, because you're just, like, dunking it.
Like, maybe a cheese recipe would already say, gotta use this fabric, and everybody would just be like, whatever. Makes sense to me.
Speaking of fabric in food, did you know that this is becoming a widely known fact now, which is amazing? First pink lemonade was made pink by putting into the lemonade a
circus performers' tights.
Oh.
Is that true?
Why?
I feel like I read it somewhere in like one of those 100 fact books that I now know not to bring up. Trivia knowledge from.
That one turns out to have been accurate. The person who made Pink Lemonade, not to be trusted.
I'm going to go with the music one. I think I
music.
Got it. I feel okay. compelled.
I think I'm also going to go with the music. It feels like an art student thing to do.
Well, Swiss cheesemaker Beat Wampfler, his name is Beat Wampfler, and his collaborators at the university ran their experiment using 9 22-pound wheels of cheese, which were kept for 6 months in their own wooden crates in a cheese cellar, and each cheese was hooked up to a mini transducer, which sends sound waves directly into the cheese. From there, the cheese was stuck listening to a 24-hour loop of one song. The group tried out music from different genres. They had The Magic Flute from Mozart. They had Stairway to Heaven from Led Zeppelin. They had Monolith from Yellow. I don't know what that is.
I don't know.
They
that
got
one.
Jazz. They played some hip hop. They played A Tribe Called Quest. And they played Techno by Vril, which I'm sure is an artist of electronic music. As controls, there was a cheese left to listen to silence, which I now feel bad for.
That's
for some reason.
Cheese,
and
yeah.
Three cheeses that were stuck listening to a tone that was either high, medium, or low frequency. The idea is that the sound waves like travel through the cheese bodies. And the only test of this experiment really focused on were taste tests. They gave it to food technologists and a panel of culinary experts to judge in a blind taste test. And in general, the Hip Hop's cheese seemed to have the strongest flavors.
Wow. That's a perfect name for a guy who's playing music to cheese, specifically.
Beat
his
Wampfer.
First name's Beat, right?
His first name's Beat. And his last name is Wampfer, which sounds like the noise that comes out of the speaker when you're listening to Vril.
through a bunch of cheese. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd try some out, but I don't think that it would be worth it. Next up, we're going to take a short break, and then the fact off. SciShow Tangents is brought to you by Rocket Money, a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. As you know, Tangents is a show about science. With that in mind, I've gone out into the field to do some personal research for this ad. Join me as I observe in his natural habitat, the money dummy, a lowly creature who lacks the natural ability to know how many subscription services he's even subscribed to.
Ah, another beautiful day being a money dummy without a care in the world. I'm one of the 75% of people who have subscription services that I've forgotten about, just sucking away at my bank account like a tick on a deer. But that's okay with me. Who needs extra money? Now to just have a drink from this pond. Gulp, gulp,
gulp. Rawr!
Oh, no.
Dear Lord, there was a money smarty in that pond, laying in wait for the hapless money dummy. Why, she's devoured him whole.
Foolish money dummy. I, the money smarty, use that extra money to become a deadly predator and get the drop on you. But here's my dark secret. I used to be a money dummy, too. Evolution happened real fast, I guess. That is, until I used Rocket Money to find and cancel my unwanted subscriptions and cancel the ones I didn't want. Then I used Rocket Money to monitor my spending and build budgets until I became the impressive specimen you see today. And I'm not alone. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. And if you had gotten Rocket Money, money dummy, you'd be a money smarty too, instead of my dinner.
That's really interesting. Too bad I didn't know.
And so the beauty and horror of nature laid bare. And what did we learn? How about to stop wasting your money on things you don't use? Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/tangents. That's rocketmoney.com/tangents. rocketmoney.com/TANGENTS. All right, everybody, welcome back. Sari's in the lead with 2 to Sam's 1. Now it's time for the fact off. Our panelists have brought science facts to present to me in an attempt to blow my mind, and after they have presented their facts, I will judge them and award my Hank Bucks anywhere I see fit. But to decide who goes first, I have a trivia question. The Washington State University Creamery produces a canned white cheddar cheese called Cougar Gold, which has been around since the 1940s. I love cheese names. They're so good. Every one of them sounds made up. It was produced to send troops overseas. Creating a canned cheese was a challenge because the bacteria inside cheese produced carbon dioxide, which would explode the cans. So the inventors of Cougar Gold were able to assemble a new bacteria culture that produced less CO2. The result is a cheese that can be stored for quite a while. In 2010, the parents of a former Washington State University alumna called the creamery to let them know that they were driving through with a can of Cougar Gold that might have been one of the oldest unopened cans at the time. How old was that can of cheese?
55 years?
Sarah's going with 55 years old.
What's the maximum amount? Like 70. Just as old. It was the first can that rolled off the canning thing.
Well, you know, it's going to sound less impressive now that I've set it all up, but 22, 23 years. 23-year-old can of cheese.
If they called me, I'd say throw it away. I don't want to see it.
I don't need that.
That cheese is from the 90s or something. Is that right?
Yeah.
No, it's from the 2000s. No, it's even. From the 2000s. No, I don't care about this cheese.
It was 1987. In 2010.
That's the year I was born. So I'd say bring me the cheese, actually. This is exciting cheese.
Do you guys know about cup of cheese?
No.
Where you fart in your hand and then you put it on someone's face and you say, cup of cheese.
Hank. I didn't like that.
Don't say stuff like that.
The first time I ever saw someone do cup of cheese in real life, I was like, that's the best thing I've ever seen.
That's disgusting.
And I was a grown man. I was like 30 years old.
If you ever do that to me, I'm never talking to you again.
Oh, I would never do it to a person, but I did watch Lee Newton do it to Joe Beretta, and I was very happy. So yeah, the cheese was stamped October 9th, 1987, and the can of cheese had been given to the couple by their daughter, and they had just kept it around thinking that they would one day have that cheese. We all have that can of cheese.
Absolutely. Well, you don't see us calling the factory and saying, I got such old beans.
Yeah. The cheese was opened, which seems like a bad decision. And it was a little more dry than it usually would be, but overall, it still tasted pretty good, according to the people who put it in their literal human mouths.
How weird, eh?
All right, that means that Sarah gets to go first. That was a long question.
So humans experience a whole range of emotions, and one of the trickier parts of being a neuroscientist or psychologist is studying the bad feeling ones, like pain or anger or disgust. You want to make sure people consent to being made uncomfortable, and some of these sensations can veer on being dangerous. Our understanding of disgust, for example, is that it's a distancing response where you feel nauseated or your body might be trying to protect itself from a toxin or potential infection or something you're allergic to. So it's not the most ideal or ethical research methodology to study disgust by exposing subjects to like moldy Tupperware or sewage. And it's hard to find something that's both easy to access and universally disgusting because people have all different cultural contexts. But there is a food that is both polarizing and completely safe as long as you're not eating a 23-year-old can of it, which is cheese. And part of that is because cheese comes in so many different varieties, including ones with really strong odors and funky flavors that people either love or love to hate. So there was a study published in October 2016 called The Neural Bases of Disgust for Cheese, an fMRI study, where researchers conducted several different experiments on cheese and disgust. Their main one was comparing the brains of people who liked cheese and people who didn't. And who were disgusted by it as they smelled it and looked at pictures of cheese. So they got 15 participants who liked cheese, didn't have to love it, just like it. 15 participants who didn't like cheese or were disgusted by it and made sure that their noses were working and they weren't sick at the time of the study. It does not seem like they asked whether any of these participants were lactose intolerant or not, at least that I could find in their methodology. Which would have been a question that I might have asked, but maybe they did. They just didn't write about it or I missed it. And while their brains were getting scanned using fMRI, which is functional magnetic resonance imaging, which basically measures how blood is moving in your brain, and it's a pretty standard technique to estimate which regions are active at a certain time, they had people smell 12 different things, 6 different cheeses, so blue cheese, cheddar cheese, goat cheese, Gruyere, Parmesan, and Tome, Tome. That's the only one I haven't heard of. And 6 non-cheese foods. Cucumber, fennel, mushroom, pate, peanut, and pizza. Seems like a very broad cross-section of non-cheese foods.
Peanut.
And what they found is that what they called the anti-cheese people had stronger activation in some parts of the basal ganglia region of the brain than the pro-cheese people. Specifically, these regions called the globulus pallidus and the substantia nigra. And these regions are usually associated with reward pathways. And so what's weird is they seem like they're also involved in these anti-reward disgust behaviors as well. So the same regions that are saying, yes, you want this, are also saying even more strongly, no, you don't want this. And then plus the ventral pallidum, which is a brain region that helps us process and move forward with behaviors that we're motivated to do, was significantly less active in the people who were disgusted by cheese than those who liked it. So the desire to want or eat or act was somehow suppressed in their brains when they smelled or looked at a picture of cheese. They were like, ooh. So there aren't any like sweeping conclusions here because it's a small study, but I like this idea that like it's hard to ethically study disgust. And so how do you do it? Cheese.
Stink them up with some cheese.
Brain studies are always so weird because it's like, can't I tell you why I don't want the cheese? And they're like, no, you can't. You have no idea. We need to put you in a very expensive machine and figure out where the blood is in your brain while you're smelling cheese.
And then those regions are only, we only know what they do because of other studies where they had people look at other things that they liked or didn't like. And so we're all just guessing.
So there's definitely, there is plenty of insight to be gleaned by being the actual thing experiencing the sensation. Because I think that when I smell a cheese that I don't like the smell of, it's because it smells like things I wouldn't want to put in my mouth. Like feet. Sometimes it smells like feet.
That's okay.
Sometimes it's, But that is true. Sometimes it smells like feet and I'm like, that smells like feet. Yeah. But that's okay. And then sometimes it smells like feet, and I'm like, that smells like feet, but too much.
Wrong kind of feet. Too stinky of feet. That's true.
Every cheese has a little bit of funk. Except for Kraft Canadian cheese.
Yes.
Which just has that glossy texture of silly putty. Sam, what do you got for me?
Emeryville, California, home to companies such as Pixar, Clif Bar, and Pete's Coffee, this booming city nestled in California's Silicon Valley is a modern economic powerhouse. But this isn't the first time that Emeryville's been a modern booming economic powerhouse. Being situated on San Francisco Bay and filled with train yards, Emeryville became a manufacturing center, like starting from when it first was founded. Paint, car, and train parts, rubber, canning, it was all in Emeryville, baby. But being a manufacturing center comes with some ugly side effects, chief among them being industrial waste. Corporations tend not to be the best stewards of the land, especially in the early 20th century when most of this manufacturing was happening, so that waste would end up dumped in the ocean or on the ground, either accidentally, intentionally, or maybe a little bit of both. So by the 70s, manufacturing was moving out of the U.S., and mostly all that was left in Emeryville was empty buildings and various toxic wastes that manufacturing left behind. So much so that a Slate article I read while researching this said that green goo would sometimes seep out of the ground when Emeryville, like when people were building stuff in Emeryville on construction sites, they'd dig, green goo would come out. So in the 80s, the EPA moved in and started spending money to clean stuff up, either through Superfund sites or grants to smaller programs. And one of those smaller programs is where cheese enters the picture. But first, I got to talk about chrome plating, which is a process that I don't entirely understand, where a metal object is placed in a solution of chromium, which is a hard, rust-proof, shiny element, to plate that object in chromium, thus making the object hard, shiny, and rust-proof. The type of chromium used in electroplating is called hexavalent chromium, which is really water-soluble, but it's also a dangerous carcinogen and really good at seeping into groundwater, which makes it a high-priority chemical for the EPA when it comes to cleaning stuff up. And in Emeryville, there's a parcel of land that used to be home to a chrome plating factory. And even though there weren't any major reported spills of hexavalent chromium from the factory, the soil was still rotten with the stuff, and it was seeping into the groundwater, which is not good. In 2004, a project was funded to clean the land, and three solutions were proposed. The first was to wait for the chromium to break down, which would take like forever, I think. The second was to dig up and incinerate all of the contaminated dirt, which was crazy expensive. And the third was to pump 15,000 gallons of cheese whey into the ground. And the cheese was the answer. So while hexavalent chromium is super soluble, trivalent chromium is not. Because of electrons, I think, or something.
Yeah.
So the more electrons that are available to chromium, the more likely it is to take its trivalent form, which are more stable and less toxic and soluble than hexavalent. And something with a whole lot of electrons to give, apparently, is organic soil matter created by the life processes of soil-dwelling bacteria. So just like probiotic yogurt helps the bacteria in your belly, the cheese whey, which was pumped into the ground via several wells, helped bacteria in this contaminated soil flourish, poop, and breathe, and not do all that stuff to make organic compounds that expedited the trivalentization of the chromium. And really, I think they could have pumped any pumpable food into the ground, probably like yogurt or whatever, like, you know, like your belly. But cheese whey was picked because it was really cheap, and there was a place really close that was making lots of cheese whey, so they said, why not? However, much to my extreme frustration, I couldn't actually find like a newer article than 2004, basically, about this and how it worked out. But this is a process that's used in other soil remediation efforts, where it's reduced hazardous chemicals by up to 90% in 3 months. But if you pumped, if you are somebody who pumped cheese into the ground in Emeryville, California in 2004, please contact us and tell us if it worked.
I love that. I don't, how do they get the cheese in the ground?
Just they had a big tank and they drilled a bunch of holes and they put hoses in it and they pumped it into the ground. And I want to see it like, so bad.
I was going to say, you said that it was because of electrons. And I was going to say, well, that you could say that up for everything. But Ceres kind of like, I was like, you probably said that for Ceres fact, but then I was like, not really. Like, MRIs are one of the few things that's actually about protons.
Oh.
Which is, like, electrons aren't that involved in MRIs, which is wild, very unusual. But ultimately, if I'm going to choose, and I have to, I got to go with the just pumping a bunch of cheese into the ground.
Hank, will you send me around to super fun sites all over the world or all over the country?
Oh, that would be an amazing show.
I could be super fun Sam. I could say,
Super fun Sam.
Yeah.
And if you, did you say super fun? No, I didn't say super fun.
Unfortunately, really not.
All right. Well, I'm gonna give Sam, I'll say five Hank bucks for that, and Sari, I'll give three.
Are we tied?
I think you win, Sam.
Oh, you're right. I had one from the first game.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that means that it's time to ask the Science Couch, where we ask a listener question to our couch of finely honed scientific minds.
Red Locker on Discord asked, what makes cheese addictive to humans? Is it some part of the cheese itself or my own developing sense of self-control?
I mean, I think that the thing that makes cheese addictive is the fact that it's got sugar and fat in it and salt. And that's what we want. We want sugar and fat and salt.
But that is there something special about cheese that makes it that this question's referring to, or is that just anything?
I don't know.
Like that?
There's ongoing conversation about addictiveness and food, but you kind of can't like we probably shouldn't be talking about food as addictive, but certainly you can develop a thing where you have an unhealthy relationship. And also there is a thing where there are certain foods that we eat more than we otherwise would because of their flavor, mostly like because of the things that they're made up of. And you can sort of design a food to be the right mix of salty, fat, and sweet. And you're like, I ate a bag of Doritos just now and I loved it.
So I think the root of this question, or the root of a lot of the is cheese addictive phrasing, there was a bunch of like popular science articles that came out around the year 2015, because there was a study published called Which Foods May Be Addictive: The Roles of Processing, Fat Content, and Glycemic Load. And so this study came in two parts. One, where they surveyed 120 undergraduates at the University of Michigan. And two, they found 398 participants on Mechanical Turk, which is the Amazon product where you can get paid like 50 cents, 5 cents, whatever, for answering the question. They basically gave these people surveys about what foods made them feel like they couldn't stop eating or like they regretted it afterwards. And they mapped those feelings onto like food, quote unquote, food addiction. Like Hank was saying, that's not really the most accurate way to describe it. Like addiction is a very specific set of criteria when it comes to certain drugs or toxins like alcohol or things like that, that psychologically you become dependent on. Food, you need it to survive. Like you need to eat. And so you can get cravings for things. And maybe there's like complicated emotions around certain foods.
This is why I think we talk about it as addiction, because you have the same, a lot of the same pathways in the brain, like the reward pathways. But I think that it's mostly like, we need to like, we, you don't want to talk about food addiction because food is necessary and is like, and is a normal part of life, unlike, you know, cigarettes or alcohol or gambling or something.
And the findings from the study, as they hypothesized, which is like highly processed foods with added fat, refined carbohydrates, and additional salt appeared to be most associated with these like behavioral indicators. So like the top ranked foods, 1 through 9, were chocolate, ice cream, french fries, pizza, cookie, singular, chips, plural, cake, popcorn, buttered, cheeseburger. And that was like,
ooh, great foods.
Hey,
great foods. And so all, a lot of study, like articles were like, oh, cheese, like cheese is Canadian cheese singles, Canadian craft singles, are all these things are like these highly processed foods. And so like you're addicted to cheese. But that's like not what the study was saying. And it's kind of a classic case of, especially in the nutrition space, I think people like to make sweeping conclusions about what other people should or shouldn't eat. Like a subset of this, the rabbit hole that I fell down, is this idea that casein, that milk protein, that is like 80% of the proteins in cow's milk, when you metabolize casein, and there's several different types of casein, but specifically like one of them that's found in cow's milk, turns into a compound called casomorphin. And casomorphins are a class of compound that fall into the category of opioids. And because it's an opioid, then of course people make that connection almost immediately of opioid addiction. The problem is like the opioid system in your body exists as it is. Like neurotransmitters, your brain naturally makes our opioids that enable communication between your neurons, help your body communicate things like pain or pleasure or memory or like the movements of your digestive system, contractions and like constipation or diarrhea. Like all of those are opioids. And so it makes sense that a digested compound from milk, which is also something that's in the human body, would then interact with the opioid system because you have to digest the food. And there's a wave of people who are in like the nutrition space who are like, we're going to try and link casomorphins, or there's evidence that casomorphins are linked to diabetes and heart attacks and like too much eating cheese or dairy products in general. Whereas the reviews, I found one from 2009 from the European Food Safety Authority and one from 2023 from like a Sao Paulo, New Zealand team, where they're just like, we don't know. Like we haven't studied casomorphin in humans enough. And like, sure, if you isolate a bunch of it and inject it into animals, then it will, you might see signs of addictive behaviors or like weird biological effects. But that's because it's such a wildly high concentration and injected directly into the bloodstream. But we don't know how it interacts in humans. And also the people who are having digestive problems because of it or health problems because of it might just be like lactose intolerant. Like let's consider that maybe.
One thing I have learned about human bodies doing research on cancer is that we are really good at processing chemicals in our bodies and like dealing with them way better than I think most people assume. Even like obvious carcinogens like uranium in the air, like our bodies are fairly good at dealing with. And I'm like, if we could do that, not that there's a lot of uranium in the air. I mean, people who are like downwind of accidents and disasters. What?
Super fun, Sam, inhaling all that uranium.
I'll be okay when I'm out there on the on the job site.
If you want to ask the Science Couch your question, follow us on Twitter and on Threads at SciShow Tangents, where we will be sending out topics for upcoming episodes every week, or you could join the SciShow Tangents Patreon and ask us on our Discord. Thank you to Sid, just a guy on Discord, at Solok Holmes on YouTube, and everybody else who asked us your questions for this episode. If you like this show and you want to help us out, super easy to do that. First, you can go to patreon.com/SciShowTangents, become a patron, get access to things like our Discord, bonus episodes, maybe our Minions commentary, which might be being released quite soon. If it hasn't even already, I don't know when this episode's coming.
Possible.
Also, shout out to patron Les Aker for their support. Second, you can leave us a review wherever you listen. That's super helpful, and it helps us know what you like about the show. And finally, if you want to show your love for SciShow Tangents, just
tell people about us.
Thank you for joining us. I've been Hank Green.
I've been Sari Riley.
And I've been Sam Schultz.
SciShow Tangents is created by all of us and produced by Jess Stempert. Our associate producer is Eve Schmidt. Our editor is Seth Glicksman. Our social media organizer is Julia Buzz Bazzio. Our editorial assistant is Deboki Chakravarti. Our sound design is by Joseph Tuna Medish. Our executive producers are Nicole Sweeney and me, Hank Green. And we couldn't make any of this, of course, without our patrons on Patreon. Thank you. And remember, the mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire to be lighted. But one more thing. All around us, there are tiny, sometimes microscopic arachnids called mites, and certain species munch on the moldy rinds of aged wheels of cheese like Parmesan or the fungal veins in blue cheese. And you know you have an infestation of mites when you find dust around your cheese with a buildup of their exoskeletons, dead bodies, and of course, poop. So in many cases, cheesemakers try to protect their food from these pests. But at least two types of cheese are actually intentionally aged with a colony of mites, the French cheese Mimolette and the German cheese Mittelbinkäse, which translates to mite cheese.
That's the German way of naming stuff.
These cheeses have a characteristic lemon-like flavor, and that comes from a compound that is secreted by the mites. From their abdominal glands. At least the flavor isn't from their poop, but realistically, you're probably going to be eating some of that too.
Yeah, you're probably always eating. I'm probably eating that right now.
Yeah, it's not true that you eat a bunch of spiders every year, but it is true that you eat a bunch of mites every year. Like, it just seems like they're going to get in there.
Spiders George is actually eating mites. Yeah. It's actually about arachnids this whole time.
It turns out. Yeah, Spiders Georg eats a lot of mites, but so do you. He's a normal amount.